The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I have a friend who has a son who was born with a developmental problem, or actually it was after birth that this child's problem developed. He had a high fever and he suffered some brain damage as a very, very young infant before he was speaking. And this father faithfully taught this child and encouraged this child and helped this child and prayed with this child and taught him from the Word of God and told him about God. And as the child's development continued, the profound nature of the problems became more and more obvious. The child didn't develop normally. He walked late. He didn't speak. And until age 3.5 or 4, still had not spoken. And they didn't know if he would ever speak. And one day my friend was interacting with this child, trying to communicate truth and trying to help this child understand God's ways. And as he was speaking and was frustrated with the whole process of communication, his son intervened, and his son spoke, and his first words were, "Pray, Daddy." And I've often thought of that as a powerful illustration of the importance of the first years of a child's life. One of the problems I think fathers often have is this idea that once this kid starts walking and talking and running around and I can play with him and wrestle with him and do things with him, then I'll start to be a father. But up until then, it's really mommy's game. And I don't have anything to do with that because I'm waiting for him to be big enough for me to interact with. And I want to encourage us with the fact that our kids from the earliest days are people made in the image of God. And we need to be teaching them and training them in the ways of God. Certainly the first years of life are marked by great change. Our kids are changing in every way. In the early years of life, the child is changing in terms of their physical being. They come home as a little baby. They can't move. They stay where you put them. Don't you wish your teenagers would do that? You just set them there and say, "I'll come back for you later." They stay where you put them. They're totally dependent on you. You have to carry them from place to place. You move them around. There's all this physical change that takes place as they begin to grow and develop. And soon they're out of their cribs and they're out of their clothes and they're running around and the child is changing physically in radical ways in the first 5 years of life. Learning to walk, to talk, to feed himself, to dress himself, to care for himself, to climb trees, to hop on one foot. All the things that children learn to do, and we see this radical physical change. There's great change socially. A child comes home from the hospital. You have just this baby that has a relationship with no one except mother if they've begun to bond. And of course, he bonds first with mother, but soon he begins to have relationships with other people in the house and father and brothers and sisters. And by, this kid is carrying on relationships with other people. In fact, by the time he goes to school, he thinks of himself as a person that has friends, and there are friends that he likes to be with and play with and interact with. And there's radical change in that whole area. There's great change intellectually. Children, as my older brother Paul sometimes says, are meaning makers. They are continually trying to assign meanings to things. They're trying to understand how things work and why things work and how the world works. And they're learning all kinds of things. More learning takes place in the first 2 years of a child's life than in any other period of life. They learn that doors swing on hinges. Tons of things that they learn. They learn how to talk. They learn, in fact, the early mistakes children make in grammar are mistakes that follow the rules. Did you ever notice that? "I thinked." You say, "No, dear, I thought." But this child has said to himself, you add ED to the dictionary form to form the past tense. Well, that's amazing. You know, there's tremendous intellectual activity. And spiritually, the child is developing also. Now, because we are worshipers, because man as man is a worshiper, because we're made in the image of God, our children must be shepherded even from the very beginning along the lines of knowing God and loving God. We can either shepherd them in that direction or we can ignore all that development that takes place. But either way, this child is developing spiritually and the child is responding to the world of spiritual reality. He's either learning to worship Jehovah and to rely on Jehovah, or he's learning to bow before lesser gods. One or the other is taking place throughout the child's life. So there are rapid changes taking place in these early years. Now, I want to ask you this question. Could I ask you, brother, could you switch off that light for just a minute, then I can wander out here without being blinded. I want to ask you this question. What is a single overarching objective that you can have in these early years of the child's life? What is a way of looking at this child and understanding the child and understanding your calling as a parent, if that's the role you're in, or if you're teaching parents? What do we want parents in our churches and parents that we counsel to understand about children and about the training of children in these early years? What is an overarching objective that is narrow enough and firm enough to provide good direction in concrete situations and yet broad enough to meet this challenging world of the children? And I would suggest to you that the most important lesson for children to learn in this early period of their life is to learn that they are people made by God. They are made to live under God's rule and under God's authority. Why wait till we're dealing with teenagers before we start talking about that? Why not talk to our infants about that? Even when you're holding a 3 or 4 month old or 3 or 4 week old child in your arms, to be talking to them about the fact that they're a creature made by God and that God has designed that they live in a relationship of love and fidelity to God, that God has made them and that they are uniquely designed to carry on communion and fellowship with the living God. That this is what life is about. And this is what is important. Our kids learning that they are people who are made by God, for God, and who are designed to live under God's authority and under God's rule. I would submit to you that that's one of the most important lessons of life. That's one of the things every single one of us has had to come to grips with, even in our own spiritual walk, that we are people that are made to live in obedience to God. That we're people who are made to live under God's rule. Ultimately, as we begin to understand ourselves as creatures and who God is and understand the Christian life more fully, we begin to see that really obedience to God is one of the ways that people who delight in God show the glory of God. Isn't that what Matthew 5:16 says? Let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. That I'm a person who is made to live under God's rule and glorify God by obeying Him and loving Him and enjoying Him forever. That's true of your child. Now, one of the first places where that issue of being a person under the rule of God comes to bear on a child's life is in this area of obedience to parents. But there's this God word focus to obedience. Could I ask you to turn that on? This passage that we have up here, Paul gave me this high-tech pointer. If I see people sleeping, I may just flash your eyes with it. But this passage up here in Ephesians chapter 6 is really one of the basic texts that we need to get a hold of in understanding our kids. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and your mother, for this is the first commandment with a promise that it may go well with you and you might enjoy a long life on the earth. My parents were saved when I was 4 or 5 years old. This was our first memory verse. Somebody showed them this passage of Scripture and they had us all memorize Ephesians 6:1. In fact, my father used to just turn to us when we were being disobedient or slow on the uptake with obedience and say, "What's Ephesians 6:1?" And we would think to ourselves, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord," and we'd go off and do what we were supposed to do. One time he invited a traveling salesman home. He always took pity on traveling salesmen because he said they eat restaurant food all the time and they never had good home-cooked meals. So he would bring them home for a meal. Man came home one night and we were having a meal and throughout the evening, from time to time, when somebody would be disobedient, Dad would turn and he would say, "What's Ephesians 6:1?" And we would go and do what we were supposed to do. Finally, by the end of the evening, this fellow couldn't keep his curiosity any longer. And he said, "By the way, what is Ephesians 6:1? He thought he had stumbled on some marvelous way of training children. He thought, "Boy, I'll take this home with me. If I can understand what that means and get my kids to understand it, it seems to work miracles." Well, our children need to understand that God has really called them to obedience. God has drawn a circle, which I've labeled here as a circle of blessing. Someone asked me if this was anything like the circle of life from Lion King, and I don't know the answer to that because I didn't see Lion King. I'm culturally deprived, but this circle of blessing, I think, is actually older than Lion King's circle of life. So we'll go with this. The circle of blessing that God has given, God has drawn a circle, and he says the boundaries of this circle are the children are to honor and obey, and within that circle, they're going to have great blessing. And really, in a sense, this submission to earthly authority is one of the first places where children face the issue of submission to the authority of God. Because it's children obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Many times I said to my children, "I didn't write this book. And this book has things that pinch my feet, just like it has things that pinch your feet. And they cramp my style like they cramp your style. But God, you're confronted with in those early years of a child's life that you will not have otherwise. Because you'll begin to recognize that what's at stake here is not whether or not I am okay at this moment with what my child's doing. What's at stake here is the eternal destiny of my child. And I desperately want my child to see that God has drawn here a circle in which there is great blessing. This is not something God has done to ruin your life. This is something God has done to give you life. And God promises that it's going to go well with you. And you're going to enjoy a long life if you stay within this circle." And many times I've entreated my children with that. And they've seen tears in my eyes while I've entreated them. "Please don't resist me. Don't resist my authority, because in doing that you're resisting God. And my concern is that you love God and obey God and enjoy the long life and the blessings that God has promised to you." It makes it an issue that it also means that I can't overlook the disobedience of my child. I can't overlook his refusal to obey, because I know that at stake is not just whether or not this particular disobedience rankles me. Because whether or not it bothers me isn't the issue. The issue is who the Lord is. And the God that has called him to obey promises blessing if he obeys. Now, how are we going to define these terms? If I could ask you, brother, to put up the definitions just so we can have these in front of us. Obedience is submission to God's authority that causes a child to do what he's told immediately, without excuse, without complaint, and without question. Immediately, without excuse, without complaint, and without question. I don't know how many times I've asked people in counseling, "Does your child obey you?" And I've had this answer: "I can usually get him to do what I want him to do." Now that tells me the parent has not taught the child to obey. What the parent has learned to do is how to manipulate this child, how to offer something to the child, how to threaten something to the child, how to cajole, how to plead, how to tease, how to somehow get this child to do what I can get him to do. But the issue of obedience is really a child being submissive to God's authority so that the child does what he's told without delay, without question, without complaint, immediately. We had a list of rules in our home. We had this on a little paper, and we had drawn obedience means immediately, without excuse, without complaint, without question. And we pasted that on the inside of our kitchen cupboard so that when people came to visit our house, it didn't look like we had little Gestapo signs hanging around. We just closed the cupboard's doors, and we could leave them open when no one was around. And recently, we were looking through, in the last year or so, through some old picture albums, and we found this poster from inside the cupboard door. All three of the children were home, and all three of them immediately said, "Oh, I'd like to take that." And so we decided to keep it for a while. But it struck me that they looked at that poster as something that they prized. If we'd had three of them, they all would have wanted to take one with them. We need to help our children to understand when you're making faces, you're not obeying. When you're saying, why do I have to? Oh, all those kinds of things mean that the child's not obeying. He's not being submissive to authority. Now, there's a way that the why question can be asked that's appropriate. There's an appropriate sense in which a child can say, Dad, help me understand why you're asking me to do this. That's fair. We need to answer that question. But there's also a way of asking why that is petulant and disrespectful and demanding and inappropriate. We need to help our children understand what obedience is. And then we need to help our children to understand what it means to honor their parents. To honor their parents means to treat them with respect and esteem. It's submission to God's authority that causes a child to speak to his parents with respect for their role as God's agent for direction and discipline in their life. It means speaking to your child, to your parent, with respect and esteem. Now, that's a difficult thing to do in our culture, because we have a culture in which no one is honored. I've often been struck with the fact that regardless of what you think of our president or his performance, there's a disrespect for the office that is very marked in our culture. How many of us realize that FDR was a cripple? They used to station FDR in podiums. They would stand him up, and then they would allow the cameras in, or then the cameras would snap. But you only see few pictures of FDR in his wheelchair. You always see him either standing or sitting. He didn't walk well. But there was such respect for the presidency that no one pictured him or even took photos of him as an impotent man being carried here and there. Today, he would be being shown in that way all the time. Now, obviously, there's a difference in the ways that we view disabilities and all that. But my point is that we live in a culture where no one has respect for anyone, and it's a difficult thing to help our children understand honoring their parents. What am I talking about? I'm talking about this kind of thing. When you honor your parents, you don't speak to them in the imperative. You don't say to them, get me a drink. You say, Mommy, may I have a drink? You don't speak to your parents as though they are your chums. You don't say, oh, Dad, you're such a jerk. I can't believe you're such an idiot. I've heard children say those kinds of things to their parents. That's not honoring your parents. And we need to be prepared in these early years of our children's lives to say to them, dear, you may not speak to me that way. You may not speak to me in that tone or in that manner because God says that you're to honor me. And God is going to bring blessing and long life to you if you stay within the circle that he has provided. And you need to recognize God's authority and be a child who honors his parent. We need to say to our kids, I'm not one of your chums. You may speak to your friends in a flippant manner when you're playing together, but you may not speak to me in that way. Now, what was it that you wanted? It's got to be friendly. But we've got to hold up a standard that says, God calls on you to honor me because I'm your father. God calls on you to honor your mother. I'm persuaded that we do not have to have situations in which we have teenage children speaking to their parents in horrible and disrespectful ways. I'm also persuaded that teenage children are taught to speak to their parents in horrible and disrespectful ways by the kind of speech that parents accept when they're in this first stage of life. You're not going to deal with that very easily with a 15-year-old if you start there. But if you start with a child that's fresh from the hospital, that's still all miniaturized and can be shaped, you can provide those shaping influences that God has called for us to provide. I remember a conversation I heard recently with a mother She said to her child, "Dear, I want you to sit down now." The child kind of looked at her with this impudent grin and said, "Why?" "Well, I think you need to slow down a little bit and you need to sit down now. Now, you need just to sit down." "Why?" The child's just a little more taunting. "Because I said that you should sit down." "Why?" "Because why?" "Because why?" And then at this point, the mother turned to me and she said, "Sometimes I just can't get him to be serious." And I thought to myself, and I said to her later, "I can't imagine anything more serious. This was a very serious interchange. He was being serious. This child knew that his mother wanted his cooperation, and he did not submit to her. Things couldn't have been more serious than they were. Now, if you're going to accomplish this, obviously you're going to have to give yourself to consistency in dealing with these things. If you're going to accomplish this as a parent, you're going to have to be prepared to swim upstream, because our culture has lost any semblance of submission to authority, and you're going to have to be consistent. You must train your children to obey through careful discipline and through practical instruction. And the rules have to be the same every day. And you must challenge disobedience every time it occurs. And you must persevere until these lessons of submission to authority have been learned. And victory does not come to the faint of heart in this area. This is a difficult, hands-on, long-term process. You're not going to accomplish this in a week-long blitz. It's going to have to be day after day after day of patient instruction, day after day after day of carefully saying to your child, "I'm sorry, you may not speak to me in that way. I'm sorry, dear, you have disobeyed by not moving. When I said to you, you need to go to bed now, and you said to me, as soon as I'm done coloring this page, that was not obedience. That was an explanation for not obeying. And you can't do that. If you wish to appeal to me about coloring the page, we can talk. But when you inform me about why you're not going to obey until later, that's not obedience." And in these early years, particularly in these early years of life, we must be continually sounding that note. Clear directives, thorough enforcement, all those things are so important. Never allowing our child to disobey without dealing with that. Because when they disobey, they're moving out of the circle of blessing. And we cannot allow our child to move out of that circle without intervening and seeking to help them. Now, I've had parents quote to me the Proverbs. I think it's Proverbs 19:11. "It is the glory for a man to overlook an offense as a justification for overlooking disobedience." And I would suggest to you that they do not understand the issue. The issue in the disobedience of my parent, of my child, is not just this parent-child relationship. The issue is the child's relationship with God and the need to submit to God's authority. If it were just the parent-child relationship, then I could decide as a parent that I will be selective about when I require obedience. But if the issue is the child's submission to God's authority, and that submission to God's authority is exhibited and demonstrated and learned in the context of submission to mom and dad, then the issue is always this Godward issue, and I can't walk away from that and ignore that. Obedience is not just an issue between the parent and the child. It's an issue between the child and God. And the parent is functioning as God's agent in drawing this child back within the circle of blessing. And it's not a glory to overlook an offense of that sort. Now, there are some offenses or some things that it is a glory to overlook. Certainly, when our children spill things, kids are clumsy. When they break things, it's just stuff. It's all going to end up in a landfill anyway. You know, when they mess up your good carpet, you know, what difference does it make? You know, one of these days you're going to look at that carpet and you're going to say, "Oh, this stuff is so horrible. We've had it for 15 years. Let's get it out of here." When they show a lack of understanding of human relationships because of their youth and their youngness, and they just don't understand that when you have guests at the table, you don't tell the guests, "Elbows off the table." it's a glory to overlook an offense of that sort. But never disobedience. And you must learn to distinguish between childishness and rebellion. When my child is not obeying, he's in rebellion. And it's important that we teach children these things. Now, I think that there are some safety valves for that. After you have taught children to obey, you don't do this with a 2-year-old, but you do this with a 6, 7, or 8-year-old. I think it's important to teach children how to appeal to you as an authority and teach them that there is a way that you can come to me when I've given you a directive. And if you come to me in a way that respects my role as God's agent in your life, we can talk. And I'm willing to hear. And I'm willing to change my mind. I'm willing to say, okay, you're right. This could be done in another time. Certainly, we need to be willing to do that. We need to be willing to speak to our children. For example, you have a child who's reading in bed, and it's time for the lights to be out. And you could just simply walk down the hall and flip the switch off and say, good night, it's 8:30 or it's 9 o'clock or whatever time is bedtime. Or you can say to them, as I think you ought to, how much, you know, are you near the end of a chapter? It's after your bedtime, but I don't want to interrupt you in the middle of the chapter. If you want to finish that chapter, that's fine. So you have all those things that you can do as a parent, and you need to do to show sensitivity to your child in this issue of obedience. But we cannot give up on this matter of obedience. I'm persuaded that many of us get into great trouble with our kids because in these first years of a child's life, when they are quasi-controllable, we don't teach them to submit to authority and we don't teach them to obey. So this kid goes off to school, he's incorrigible at school, he's around other kids that are incorrigible because we live in a wicked culture where children have no fear of adults or fear of anything. And he becomes impossible to handle. But I am persuaded that we can deal with this issue of obedience, this basic structural issue of the fact that my child is to live in my home under my authority because that's what God has set out and requires. We can teach them that issue in the early years of life, and we don't have to spend our whole life training them to obey. I'm persuaded that you should never have to have contests over obedience after a child is 5 or 6 years of age. If they learn this in the early years, then you don't have to spend your whole life fighting over whether or not these kids are going to obey. I think what happens is we ignore it. And then when we begin to realize these kids are out of control, I can't handle them anymore, then we start to address it. And if I can urge you people who are here today who have children in these first 5 years of life, with all care, be teaching your children the fact that God has designed them to live under the authority of mom and dad, and that is going to bring blessing into their life. If they buy into that, it changes everything. I recall one time with my 15-year-old son, or my 26-year-old son when he was 15, talking to him about disobedience and speaking to him in a way that was really wrong. I can't remember what the issue was. It wasn't a major thing where he had been defiant, but it was something where I felt that he had not done what I wanted him to do, and I felt my wishes were clear enough, and he hadn't done what I expected. And I spoke to him really in a sinful way. I was angry, and I talked to him in ways that were wrong. They were ungodly, and they were wicked. And I went to him later, and I said to him, I'm sorry, Ted, I spoke to you sinfully. I was angry. The energy behind what I was saying was anger and frustration, and I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And he said, okay, I forgive you. And I hugged him, and he hugged me, and I said to him before I left his room, I said, I want to ask you something. even though I was really responding so sinfully, you seemed to be receiving what I was saying anyway. And he said to me something like this. He said, I knew that whether or not you were doing it right, that God put you in this role, and I needed to listen to you. Now, that's not going to happen with a 15-year-old if you start that training at age 15. It's not going to happen. He's going to say, who are you? What makes you think you have the right to run my life? I have my own ideas. I've sat in counseling offices with kids who are 13, 14, 15 years old who talked in those terms. But the seeds for that were all present. That flower was growing in this child in the first 5 years of life. It just didn't begin to flower and blossom until they were older. You and I have to be examples of all this. We live in a culture where it's difficult to teach submission to authority, and there are a few models to follow. You and I have to be an example of this, because these ideas of our culture's ideas of equality and dignity of the person and all that are not rooted in Scripture. And because they're not rooted in Scripture, we've lost the idea of respect for a person because he is in a place of authority. So we need to be models, too, of submission to authority. We need to be models of mutual submission in our husband-wife relationships, and certainly in a wife and husband's relationship. We need to be models of the kind of relationship a person ought to have to the state and to the church. We need to be models of it in our workplace and not talk about our boss like he's a jerk or some kind of an idiot. And we need to be shepherding our kids into understanding God's ways. I'm persuaded that learning to submit to authority is a marvelous place, a marvelous opportunity to begin to shepherd your child's relationship to God. Because here's the spiritual dynamic going on. God calls for your child to obey mom and dad. That's God's directive. And your children need to be brought to see that living in God's world as creatures made by God means submission to a good and wise God in all things. And the call to submit to mommy and daddy is a call to trust God rather than to trust themselves. Because self says, do what you want. Do what feels good. Self says not to submit. Self says do what you want, when you want, how you want. And the call of obedience is a call for a child to submit to God rather than to submit to himself. What a wonderful opportunity to confront our children with what goes on inside. Because what is inside the child by nature is not a heart of submission. And see, when I begin to deal with these issues of submission to God's authority, I begin to confront that child with the fact that within him dwells a heart that is rebellious. Within him dwells a heart that wants no rule other than his own rule. I'm confronting them with their weakness. I'm confronting them with their inability to obey apart from God's strength. I'm confronting them with their need for God and their need for a Savior. And again, in the context of dealing with disobedience, I can address my child and say to them, honey, I understand why you struggle like this. What a marvelous opportunity, because I can stand in solidarity with that child. Even though I'm over him in terms of God's authority structures, I'm in solidarity with him as another person who's a sinner and who understands why it's hard to obey. Do you understand why it's hard to obey? Is there anyone here who never struggles with obedience to God? Where do you go with that struggle? You go to Christ and his cross. You repent. You ask God for mercy and grace. You cry out to him. You acknowledge his right and rule over you, and you ask him to work within you and to give you grace and the ability to obey and to do what you're supposed to do. And that's exactly where we need to be taking our kids. But see, if you're never confronting these issues, you're missing the opportunity. You're missing the opportunity to shepherd them. You're missing the opportunity to stand alongside them and say to them, I understand that it's hard to obey. I understand that when you have another person saying, I want you to go to bed now, that's very difficult. And Christ has come because that's not in your heart. And Christ can give you grace and strength to learn to obey and to respond. You see, I'm persuaded the gospel seems irrelevant to a smug child who's never required to do anything he doesn't want to do. It seems irrelevant to an arrogant child who's been taught all of his life how wonderful he is. But the gospel has a great, great relevance for a child who's been persuaded that God calls him to do something that is not in his native sinful heart to do, and to learn to joyfully submit to the authority of someone else and willingly put myself under the authority of someone else out of respect for God requires the grace of God and the mercy of God working in a child's life. Because it's only the power of the gospel that's going to produce the ability to respond. Now, some of you might be sitting here thinking, I'm already in trouble. Because you're talking about the first 5 years of life, and I've got one of those 15-year-olds, or I've got one of those 8-year-olds, or 10-year-olds, or whatever. And I want to encourage you with the fact that you can start wherever you are. Just as an illustration, I remember one year, years ago, when I was not yet in the ministry, and I was working as a contractor. We were called by a man to build a foundation under a house that existed. It was a lakefront property that had been built on piers, and he decided he wanted a basement under it. Well, it was February, and we didn't have any work, so we did it. Built a basement underneath this house. We excavated the house and put it in wheelbarrows and carried it out until we could stand up in it. And eventually, we poured walls and we poured a floor and we built a foundation under the house. Now, that's not the best way to build houses. And I highly recommend foundation first methods, but it's possible. And I think in a sense, if you have the opportunity to lay the foundation in the first 5 years of life, that's definitely preferable. That's the way to go. But you can put a foundation under the house after it's built. And you can teach your children to obey. And one of the things I think parents need to do who are in a situation where they haven't done any of this is they need to say to their kids, they need to go to their children and say, we didn't understand. We missed the boat. We failed to, whatever the reason is. We didn't know the Lord then. We didn't understand His word or this teaching or whatever your case may be. We failed to teach you what we should have taught you. This is what we should have taught you if we'd been able to. We weren't able. We didn't do it. But we see now that we need to. And so this is where we're going to start. And you begin working with them. I've seen parents do that. I can think of a couple that I know that have taught children after they were 10 or 12 years old to respect God's structures of authority. It's harder to do, but it's possible. May God give us courage to entrust ourselves to God and to do that. Now, if I can ask you to put up the next chart, one of the implications of this first chart is this. If God has drawn a circle here in which my child is to live, in which it'll go well with him and he'll enjoy a long life, when my child leaves the circle through disobedience and dishonoring, because the boundary of the circle is to honor and obey, so if he dishonors or disobeys, he leaves the circle. When he leaves the circle, he's in a place of danger. By implication, it's danger because it'll go well for him and he'll enjoy a long life inside the circle. So we must conclude that if he's outside the circle, it won't go well for him and he won't enjoy a long life. And discipline and correction functions to bring the child back inside the circle. You see, in a sense, we need to think of discipline and correction as a rescue mission. Discipline and correction is mom and dad saying, my child is in danger and I'm going to rescue him. Now, can you imagine you're watching the Super Bowl because your church cancels Sunday nights and Super Sunday or whatever. And you have a child that's 3 years old. And your 3-year-old child is outside, but you're kind of engrossed in the game, and it only comes once a year. And one of the older children run in, and they say, "The baby's out in the street." And you say, "Well, as soon as this quarter is over." I mean, which of us would do that as parents? You know, if we thought our child is in imminent danger, the Super Bowl would somehow become unimportant, and we'd be out there trying to rescue the child. And in a sense, that's exactly what we're confronted with in disobedience. Our child has gotten himself in a situation of danger brought about by his disobedience. My desire as a parent is to rescue that child. Discipline and correction functions to bring that child back inside the circle where God has promised him long life and blessing. Now, again, let's ask the same question. What is the function of correction and discipline? It's to bring the child back inside the circle. Who benefits then? The child. See, as a parent, you benefit only in a secondary sense. The primary beneficiary of your activity is the child. Because the child is being rescued from a place of danger and placed into a place of safety. He's the beneficiary. And we should not withhold that blessing from our kids. We can't be indifferent to them being in a place of danger. So we have to be prepared to deal with that and to respond to that danger. Now, I'm persuaded that in the early years, the first 5 years of life, the primary means of correction and discipline, a primary means, is spanking. And I want to look at some passages of Scripture that you probably are familiar with, but so we root it in the Scripture. And I want to talk about spanking our children, particularly in these first 5 years of life. Let me give you an illustration, though, first, that meant so much to me as a pastor, you can't imagine. I remember hearing this correction session, this discipline session going on, overhearing this discipline session. It involved somebody from our church. And I heard these words, "Dear, you know that what mommy said, and you didn't obey mommy, so I'm going to have to spank you. Now, dear, you know that I'm not mad at you, but you must learn to obey." Now, the baby was absolutely mute in the face of this correction. And the reason the baby was mute in the face of the correction is that the baby was a doll. And the mommy who was correcting was a 4-year-old little girl. And what struck me, and meant so much to me as a pastor, is that this little girl had learned to discipline dollies from how mommy had disciplined her. And there was a order to it. There was a clear structure to the discipline. There was a gracious manner in this make-believe discipline session. The lines were well rehearsed because this little girl had heard these lines many, many times. There was no anger in her voice, only firmness. There was a clear objective: you must learn to obey. And there was nothing in the manner or spirit of this young imitator of mommy that sounded or looked anything like child abuse. She was disciplining her dolly in the way that her mommy had disciplined her. And I thought, what a striking example in a culture that has concluded that all manner of corporal punishment is cruel and abusive. And I would be very surprised if I'm not talking to many people this morning who have concluded that spanking children is an idea that is out of vogue and out of fashion, and something that enlightened parents of the 90s shouldn't do. And I want to try to disabuse you of that notion this morning, because I'm persuaded it's something that you must do. Now, we know that in the world of ideas, things are always in flux. And I think sometimes we forget how much we are impacted by the ebb and flow of ideas in a culture at any given time. Ideas have popularity and unpopularity, sort of like colors do. You know, few years ago, mauve was all the thing. And now it's dark green. And, you know, sooner or later, pink and black will come back again. Remember that in the mid-50s? But ideas are just like paint, just like colors that go in and out of fashion in the fashion world. I have a friend who was trying to sell a house, and the realtor said, "You got to get rid of this harvest gold kitchen with the avocado bathroom. If you do something about that, we can sell this house." Well, you know, when that house was built in the 70s, harvest gold kitchens and avocado bathrooms were all the rage. But now you go in and you think, ugh, why did anyone ever put this in a house? But my point is, though, that ideas are like that, too. If I were talking to you in the 50s, I would not feel the least bit of self-consciousness about talking about spanking. Because, you know, everyone dealt with their kids like they were John Wayne, and, you know, Dad was this strong, silent type, and, you know, he didn't say much, but once in a while he'd trot me out to the woodshed. But we live in a different era, don't we? Different winds are blowing now, and we live in an era when the ideas of human rights and dignity and all that have made spanking children seem barbaric. And we need to be sensitive to the potential for child abuse. That's important. We don't want to have parents feel that they have the right to hit their children whenever they wish to. But because of that, many Christian people have given up on the idea of spanking. And let me just talk a little bit about the rationale behind it. What's it really designed to accomplish? Is it really necessary? Is there a better way? And I think we have to start with recognizing what the nature of the problem is. The nature of the problem is that our children are not ethically neutral. They're not born ethically neutral. They need correction. They need direction. They need discipline. They need instruction. The most basic problem that your child has, though, is not just a lack of information. The Bible teaches that the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. And your child's problem is not just that he lacks information. Your child's problem is that he's a sinner. And there are things within the heart of the sweetest little baby that, allowed to grow to fruition, will bring about the destruction of that child. And the rod functions in that context. It's addressed to needs within the child that cannot be met by talk. I don't understand how it works, but I know that God's Word says to us in passages, if you want to jot passages down, Proverbs 22:15, folly is bound up in the heart of a child. That word is a notion of foolishness, the same idea as the fool has said in his heart there's no God. It's that kind of foolishness that is bound up in the heart of a child. But the rod of discipline will drive it far from him. God says there's something wrong with your child's heart, that foolishness is bound up in his heart, and it has to be removed because it places the child at risk. And that foolishness, learning the fear of the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom, is going to come through the context and through the instrumentality of using the rod. Because the fool is someone who won't hear reproof. The fool is someone who won't submit to authority. The fool is someone who mocks at the ways of God. Proverbs 9, 7 through 9, talk about that. The fool's life is run by his fears and his desires. And that's what you hear from your children, isn't it? Even 2 and 3 year olds. I want, I don't want. They're being pushed and pulled by their desires and their fears and their lusts. They live their lives out of their cravings and their expectations and their hopes and their fears. And so it's the nature of the child underneath that rumpled hair and his smiles and his freckles and all that's so cute and huggable and kissable about them and all the rest of that is a child whose natural state is one of folly. They're going to resist correction. They're going to protest against your attempts to rule them. They're going to struggle against you. Did you ever watch even an infant struggling against mommy putting on a hat? And this kid is turning his head and doing everything he can to get rid of that hat. Did you ever try to hold a 8-month-old in your lap who decided that they didn't want to sit in laps anymore? You get that stiff body. You can't hold that child on your lap anymore because he's got a bend to stay on your lap. And he stiffens out his body. And that foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child, allowed to root and grow for 14 or 15 years, will produce a rebellious teenager that will not have anyone's rule in his life. And God's ordained the rod for this purpose. He's ordained this whole process to drive foolishness from the heart of the child. There's something about the confrontation with this immediate and undeniably tactile sensation of a spanking that makes an implacable child sweet. And the Proverbs are replete with instruction that the rod is given for this extremity. Punish him with a rod and save his soul from death. Proverbs 24:14. Your children's souls are in danger of death. Your task as a parent is to rescue them from certain death, and faithful and timely use of the rod is the means of rescue. Now that places the rod in its proper setting, because it's not a matter of the parent venting his anger. The rod is not about the parent being angry. It's not about the parent saying, I've had it with you, and now I'm going to start hitting you. That's not a biblical use of the rod. That's child abuse. That's sin. That's wicked. That's wrong. But the rod is a faithful parent, recognizing his child is in a dangerous state, employing God-given remedy. The issue is not your insistence that you be obeyed. The issue is that your child needs to be rescued from death. The death that will result from the rebellion of his heart remaining unchanged. Because if he stays out there in that place of danger, he's headed towards certain destruction. How does it work? You know, I don't know how it works. I used to say to my kids sometimes, I don't understand why God ordained for me to do this. I don't understand how it works. I don't know anything that's more unpleasant to me. I don't like violence. I've never been in a fight my entire life. I'm 49 years old and I've never been in a fight my entire life. I always found a way to avoid fights. I could grovel or do anything to get out of a fight. But God says in Proverbs 29:15 that the rod of correction imparts wisdom. Wisdom, of course, you know the Proverbs attaches wisdom to the fear of the Lord. Fearing the Lord and having wisdom comes through the instrumentality of the rod. Hebrews 12 says, no discipline seems pleasant at the time, but it's painful. However, later it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. The rod of discipline produces a harvest of righteousness and peace. Now, some people ask these kinds of questions. Don't all children learn to obey eventually? Not according to the Proverbs. The rod of correction imparts wisdom, but a child left to himself disgraces his mother. Proverbs 29:15. Discipline your child and he will give you peace. He will bring delight to your soul. Proverbs 29:17. God has commanded the use of the rod. God has commanded that you use the rod to correct your children. That's not the only thing you do. You don't do it through all of their life. But particularly in these first years of life, the rod is an undeniably powerful tool to teach our children the importance of submitting to authority. If we're going to rescue our child from death, if we're going to root out that folly that is bound up in their hearts, we must use the rod. Now, there's some questions that come around this whole issue of spanking. When do I spank? When does a child need a spanking? Well, I would submit to you that when you have given a directive that he has heard and that is within his capacity to understand, and he has not obeyed without challenge and without delay and without excuse, he needs a spanking. And if we fail to spank, we're not taking God's word seriously. In effect, we're saying, I do not believe what the Bible teaches about the rod imparting wisdom. I do not believe what the Bible teaches about the rod driving out the folly that's bound up in your heart. I don't believe that. So I'm not going to do it. We're saying we don't love our child enough. Proverbs say that the parent who loves the child disciplines him. So the win of spanking is so simple that I think we miss it. The win of spanking is that when your child is not obeyed, he needs to be spanked. When he's failed to respond to your direction, he has moved outside the circle of blessing. And when he's done that, he needs to be dealt with. And failure to be consistent on that is a capricious thing. Inconsistency really means that correction revolves around your convenience rather than objective biblical principle. And I'm persuaded that that's where many of us go wrong with spanking and why we conclude that it doesn't work. Because we only spank when we're fed up. We only spank when we're angry. We only spank when we feel like I've had it with you. And that your child will resist that kind of unrighteous treatment. There's something in a child that will resist a parent or an authority dealing with them in a capricious, unrighteous way and venting anger against them. And the child will never respond to that kind of discipline or that kind of correction. If we accept challenge, if we accept delays or excuses, we're not training our child to submit. We're rather training our children to manipulate the authorities in their life and to live on the ragged edge of disobedience. We must not warn. It doesn't help if you say, now, I'm only going to tell you one more time. We must not ask them if they want to be spanked. You see, whatever we do of that nature, we're training them when they have to obey. You know, if you say to your, speak to your child in a normal tone, he doesn't obey, and he heard you, and this request is within his range of ability and all the rest of that, and he doesn't obey, and so you raise your voice, or you yell at him, or you threaten him, or you count to 10, or whatever it is that you do, what you're teaching the child is that when you have done that is when he has to obey. Why not just back that process up and make it when you say, it's time to go to bed now? I mean, if you're going to teach him to do it at the end of 10, why not teach him to do it when you say it? How do we go about giving a spanking? If that's when we give it, how do we go about doing it? Well, there are many problems we need to avoid. And I want to give you 8 steps for properly administered use of the rod. Certainly, we have to avoid responding in anger. I must avoid treating my child without the proper respect for his person and his dignity. I must temper my unwavering firmness and insistence that he obey with kindness and gentleness toward him. And I want to suggest these steps as a procedure that provides timely discipline that preserves the child's dignity. First step is take the child to a private place. Take him to a place where he can be spoken to in privacy. Discipline must not rob the child of his dignity. And you should never discipline your children in front of the other children in the family. The objective is not to humiliate the child. And you show respect for the child by giving him privacy, by taking him to a private place where you can talk. You need to tell them specifically what they have done or failed to do. I'm persuaded that discipline must be tied to specific, easily demonstrated issues. Now, perhaps later on in our children's life, we will address them in terms of broad-range attitudinal things, and we'll talk to them as teenagers about attitudes that are broad and exhibited in many ways over many days. But when you're dealing in these first 5 years of life, it is an issue-specific spanking. So that you're going to that child and you're talking to them about a particular issue, not just a general purpose of spanking. Not just, well, I'm going to spank you for all the things that you did all day. I've had it with you today. Or I'm going to spank you for the things that you did when I wasn't looking, because I know you're always doing something. But it's got to be issue specific, a particular issue that's in view. We need to secure an acknowledgement from the child about what he's done. Now, sometimes that's going to take some time. But you might have a conversation like this. Daddy told you you should pick up your toys, didn't he? Yes. You didn't obey Daddy, did you? No. Well, then you know what Daddy must do. Daddy must spank you. Now, the child has acknowledged in that example what he's done. And that ensures that he knows why he's being spanked. And we'll talk about the other question that you're asking, what if he won't acknowledge it, in a few minutes. But I think we need to secure an acknowledgement. Fourthly, we need to remind the child that the function of the spanking is not for us to vent our anger, but it's to restore him to the place where God has promised blessing. We need to express our concern and our alarm over the fact that the child has left the circle of blessing and that we are concerned to see them restored, that the spanking reflects our obedience to God's will and our concern for the child's good. And I'm persuaded we have no right to hit our children in any other context. We don't have the right to walk through the room and, you know, give a little slap on the head or something. Or just a smack in the face when they're not expecting it because they said something that we didn't approve of. That's child abuse. Fifthly, we need to tell the child how many swats he'll receive. That's an important signal that this is a controlled event. It's not just, I'm going to spank you till my arm's tired. But it's, you know, you're going to get 3 swats. Or you can get 5 swats, or whatever you've determined is appropriate. That signals the child that you're in control of yourself, and that this isn't just something that is you're going to do without any control. I think we need to remove the child's trousers and padding so that the spanking's not lost on the padding in his pants. I've seen parents spank toddlers through those thick toddler diapers. You can't hit a child hard enough that he can feel it through one of those diapers. I mean, those paddings with all the absorbing gel and all the rest of that, forget it. He'll never know you were there. I'm persuaded that the trousers have to be removed at the last possible moment and restored as quickly as the spanking is over. And that also, during that time, the best thing to do is to lay the child across your lap. Now, some parents like to put a child across a bed or a chair, but I feel like I don't want this child on a neutral object. I want them on my lap. Besides that, it's harder to get a good swing. The whole process of having them on your lap even will make you less efficient in terms of any danger of hurting the child. But he's not being removed from you to some neutral object for the purpose of discipline. Now, after you've spanked the child, this is number 7, it's important to restore him, to take him up on your lap and hug him and tell this child how much you love him, how much it hurts you to spank him, how that you hope that you'll never have to give him a spanking again as long as he lives. Because remember, the purpose of this spanking was not retribution. The purpose of the spanking is restoration. And if my spirit in going to this child to spank him and my manner in dealing with him has not been one of personal anger and indignation, has not been one of frustration and just pounding on this child, then it has been one of deep concern for the fact that he has left the circle of safety, then restoration of that child to relationship with me ought to be the most natural thing in the world. Because this is not about anger. It's about love. And it's an expression of my love for this child. I think also the process of restoration is a good signal to you is about whether or not the child has received the spanking. If the child is pulling away and is angry, if the child won't let you hug them when you're done, then you've got some things to examine there, and we'll talk in a minute about what you need to examine. But I'm persuaded that it may mean that you haven't done your job completely. I think in that case you need to check your own spirit and say, have I handled this child roughly? Have I been out of control? Have I sinned against him in the way that I've disciplined him so that his unwillingness to be restored to me now is an expression of the fact that I have offended him and he is hurt, not just from the spanking, but he's hurt internally in the deeper ways because of the fact that I've sinned against him. And if I've done that, then I need to confess that, and I need to acknowledge that, and I need to say to my child, I'm sorry, I sinned against you. I handled you roughly. I grabbed you and jerked you around. I was angry. And I wasn't doing this in a righteous way, and I've brought my unholy anger to this process that God has ordained, and I've fouled and I've muddied the process, and that's wrong, and it's wicked, and it's sinful. Please forgive me. And we can't add to that, but you know how crazy I get when you fight. We have to own it and say, I was wrong. And the way that I handled you was wrong. So I think the first step, if the child won't be restored, is to check our own spirit. We also have to check the child's spirit and try to discern. And we obviously can't always be sure in this, but we need to try to discern. Is this anger a reflection of his rejection of the discipline? Is he just mad at me? Is he trying to punish me for what I've done? If so, then the discipline session is not over and this child's still not back inside the circle. I think the Hebrews 12 passage is very instructive. It says, no discipline is pleasant at the time, but painful. Afterward, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who've been trained by it. If the discipline has not yielded that harvest of righteousness and peace, then perhaps it is not finished. There are times when I've had to say to my children, when they were young, dear, I'm sorry, Daddy's going to have to spank you again. Because you're still angry, you're still in rebellion. You're still angry with me, and you're still not within the circle that God has called you to live within. And I'm going to have to give you a couple more swats. And we're going to have to go through this again. But this restoration process is paramount. If the issue is not your personal anger, but the child moving out from the circle of safety, then we don't want the child to be in the doghouse. When the spanking's over, it's over. Oh, it grieves my soul when I hear parents saying to their kids, don't talk to me today. Get out of my face. I don't even want to look at you. What a horrible way to treat children. That has nothing to do with biblical discipline. And those same people will say that spanking is cruel. And then we need, eighthly, to pray with the child. To encourage them with the fact that the Christ is given because we're people who sin. That there's forgiveness in Christ. That Christ can be known. That Christ can remove that heart of stone and give him a heart of flesh. That the Spirit of God can work in this child and compel this child to walk in God's ways and to love God. And enable him to obey in the future. And we need to shepherd our children in the ways of God at all times, but there's no more powerful time to do it than when our children are being confronted with the need of Christ's grace and power in the context of discipline. I often think of those times, to use an old analogy, that, boy, those are times when the wax is soft. Those are times when it's good to impress the mark of the gospel and the glories of Christ's redemption on our children. And in terms of methodology, we're using both of the procedures God has given, both the rod and correction and communication. Now, obviously, with the first 5 years, the rod is going to be more primary than communication. But because we're dealing with young children, and with young children, you can't always get their attention by drawing them into the world of ideas. But if you spank them, you get their attention. And there's something about this experience of the spanking that works the things in a child that God has promised it'll work in them. Now, why do we spank the children? Well, in one sense, it's because God commands it. Additionally, spanking enables us to deal with the issues of the heart. Remember, the heart directs behavior. Discipline's always addressed to the heart. We'll talk more about this in the next hour. But the focal point of correction is never the behavior. The focal point of the correction is the heart. The focal point is the heart of the child that is called to submission to God's authority. And the goal of correction is not just to modify the behavior, but it's to bring this child into a sweet, harmonious, humble-hearted submission to God's will and into obedience to mommy and daddy. So the heart is the battleground. And spanking comes into play because it's God's method for driving foolishness out of the heart. Also, spanking gets the child's attention. And that enables us to address the heart. It's hard to get a two-year-old's attention, but a spanking will do it. We also have to have more in our view than just the here and now. When we're spanking a two-year-old, we got to be thinking about, where's this child going to be 30 years from now? What do I want to be built into this person? Do I want him to be a person? What kind of person will he be if no one ever challenges his determination to do whatever he wants whenever he wants? What kind of a husband will he be if he refuses God's rule? What kind of an employee will he be if he never learns to submit to authority? Where will my grandchildren be 50 years from now if the foolishness bound up in the heart of this child is never driven away? How will he ever see his need of Christ's forgiveness and grace if he never faces the native rebellion of his heart and of his nature and his inability to obey God from the heart? All those things are part of why we must spank our children. Now, it's interesting. I've taught this material many times, as Jim has said, and I've taught it in many places, both in this country and in other places, and I've always had the same kinds of questions asked, so I want to try to anticipate some of those questions. When is my child old enough? When is he old enough to spank? Well, I'm persuaded when the child's old enough to resist your directives, he's old enough to be disciplined. When he is resisting you, he is disobeying. And if you fail to respond, those disobedient responses become entrenched. The longer you delay, the more intractable the disobedience will become. Rebellion can be as simple as perhaps a child fighting against a diaper change or refusing to sit on your lap. And I'm persuaded we don't begin to understand how much an 8 or 10 month old child understands. We tend to think that they begin to be sentient when they are speaking. But you know, this child has been sitting generalizing rules of language before he starts talking at age 18 or 2 months or 2 years. And so we need to recognize our kids are understanding an awful lot, even in the first year of life. I remember one of our children, I think our oldest, being about 6 or 8 months old. And we were first confronted with that problem, you know, that is one of the first comeuppances for parents. It's the mobile child. You know, now he's crawling and he's going around. And we had a bookcase. I was a seminary student here in Philadelphia at the time. We have a bookcase that was built out of bricks and shelves, you know, how poor people build bookshelves. And I still have that stuff. Goes to tell you something about being in the ministry. But we were afraid the shelf was going to fall on him because he would try to pull himself up on the shelf. And one day my wife told him, "Don't you go over there," and she corrected him and so forth. And she left the room, and when she walked out of the room, he looked over his shoulder and started crawling toward that shelf as fast as he could go. And this kid knew exactly what he was doing. He wasn't even walking yet. What if the child says, "I didn't hear you"? Now, I'll tell you what I've done with this. I've never challenged the validity of that statement. because I can't really talk about what they hear, but I have told them that they weren't, that it's not acceptable. One of our kids had a hearing problem. And I remember sitting down with them and saying to them, "You're having trouble hearing me, and I'm speaking to you in normal conversational tones. I'm close enough in proximity for you to hear me. Therefore, I must conclude that you haven't learned to pick my voice out of the other noises in the room when I speak to you. And so what I'm spanking you for is not disobeying. I'm spanking you for not hearing me." Well, we only had that spanking once, because I was persuaded that underneath this "I'm not hearing you" was a child that had really decided, "I am not willing to pull my father's voice, my mother's voice, out of the den of other noises." You know, when you want to, you can hear anything. Sometimes I listen to the radio in the car and my wife says, "How can you hear that?" But I can just filter out the static. It's amazing. If I'm listening to something I want to hear, I can listen through the crackles. And you can hear things through the crackles. Were you ever sitting across the room from someone that you knew was talking about you? You can even be in another conversation and hear what's going on. I've had parents say this to me: "If I listen to what you're saying to me, Ted, if I actually spanked my children every time they didn't obey, all I would ever do is spank my children." But I'm persuaded that if we're confronted with that much disobedience, it's because we tolerate it. That if we stopped tolerating it and started requiring obedience, we would find within a very short period of time, we would have children who were much more in tune to obeying. And there may be days when you feel like you get nothing else done. There may be days when, in fact, you get nothing else done if you have several children, but I'm persuaded that you will actually save time in the long run by doing the job right, and that it will bear good fruit, and you will find that you rescue your kids from the ways of death. Here's another question that parents sometimes ask: "What if I'm too mad?" Every parent has felt a kind of blinding rage toward a misbehaving child that murder is made of. If you've been a parent very long, you've experienced that. You've experienced those times when you are just so angry. And I think in those cases, when I'm in that kind of rage, I'm not trading in the issues of biblical correction. My agenda is satisfying my own sense of justice, and I cannot discipline my child in that time. And I think there are many times when it's appropriate to say to the child, "I would like you to go to your room, and I will come and talk to you in a few minutes," and for us to go to our room and get on our knees beside the bed and pray to God and ask God first to remove the unholy anger from our hearts and help us, if we experience anger, to have it be righteous anger, because God's law is disobeyed, not because my will is flaunted. And then to deal with our child with integrity, remain before God until we can deal with the child with integrity. Another question is, what if we're not at home? Sometimes children disobey at inconvenient times and inconvenient places. And I'm persuaded that in our culture, because it's a culture that can't distinguish between biblical discipline and child abuse, it's unwise to spank children in public. I think it may be unwise to spank them at your in-laws. It may be unwise to spank them at your brother's and sister's house. It may be unwise to spank them in your own house with the windows open during the summer. I think you're going to have to judge that, because we're living in a culture in which social service people have a very great deal of authority, and they will take your children from your house in order to begin the investigation. And by the time that you have been able to demonstrate, if you have been able to demonstrate, that it was biblical discipline that was going on, your children will have been in foster care for several weeks or months. So I think sometimes we've got to be very wise about that. And they may get away with things sometimes when they're away from home. But let me mention this. When our children are very small, most of their time is going to be spent at home anyway. So you will have the opportunity to deal with these things. And I think that it's important that our discipline be a private matter. And if we can't ensure privacy, we should not spank them in other places.